Welcome to Reader's Digest, brought to you by Owl Radio, a community service of the Low Vision Resource Center in San Antonio. I'm John Fisher, and during the next half hour, I'll be reading articles from Reader's Digest. First, I am the food on your plate, a fat bomb for hearts and minds. Here's all about avocados in Reader's Digest. The plant kingdom contains a staggering array of fruits, nearly every one trading in the same old thing, sweetness. My fruit brethren whisper sugary promises to coax animals into eating their flesh and spreading their seeds. Their offer is understandably appealing. Eating simple carbs is the fastest way for any creature on the move to get the burst of energy it needs. But me, I'm the oddball that plies my charms not with sugar, but with rich, silky fat. Once a nutritional pariah, that fat is largely what earned me my current spot as an American health darling, chunked into almost every salad and mashed into guacamole as if every day were Super Bowl Sunday. You'll get up to 30 grams of fat from each of me, and 20 of those are the monounsaturated kind, credited with raising quote-unquote good HDL cholesterol and lowering heart disease risk. I'm also great for weight control, since I'm high in fiber and abundantly satiating. What's good for the heart and belly is also good for the mind. Researchers recently found that people over the age of 50 who ate one of me a day for 6 months improved. That's improved their cognition. That's likely courtesy of a pigment I carry called lutein. You'll find it in leafy greens, too, in greater quantities, in fact. But in me, the built-in presence of my monounsaturates helps the body absorb it, eventually shuttling it to the brain. With greens, you need to add olive oil to get the same effect. As health experts began emphasizing good fats, their wish became your desire. In 1985, America ate about 4 million pounds of meat per week. That figure is projected to be 50 million in the year 2019. In other countries, I've been wildly popular for decades. In Brazil, I'm mashed with condensed milk, cream, and lime juice. In Indonesia, I'm whipped into a shake with chocolate syrup. In Morocco, I'm blended with milk, sugar, and orange flower water. But as much as you humans love me, you're not nearly the first species to clamor for my substantial flesh. Millennia ago, in my native southern Mexico and Central America, there existed beasts with digestive systems large enough to process and then disperse my massive pit. These were the so-called megafauna. Sloths that could reach 10 feet tall, armadillo-like glyptodons that were as big as small cars, and gomphotheres, cousins of the elephant, with their ginormous tusks. Historians and botanists don't know exactly which of these snacked on me, but they all would have been able to pop me into their mouths like peanuts, then poop out my pits far and wide for new trees to grow. Without them to spread my unusually large seed, my creamy green gift would have been little more than a weird and momentary blip in fruit's sugary history. Fast forward to about 13,000 years ago, when humans came along and hunted my behemoth patrons into extinction. That would have been the end of me, too, had people not decided that they also loved a dose of plant-based fat. While human digestion can't accommodate my pit, your hands can, and I was able to achieve even wider distribution through the thumb-carrying Homo sapiens who ate me and tossed my seed here and there. With agriculture, things got even better for me. I spawned into hundreds more varieties, which are today grown from South Africa to New Zealand and California to Indonesia. Some of my strains are the size of a chicken's egg, with a peel so thin you can eat its skin and flesh together, like an apple. Others are as large as a football. Some, such as the Haas, which makes up most of the American market, turn black and pebbly on the outside when mature. Others are green and smooth at peak ripeness. Thankfully for the farmers who transport me across the United States from California and Mexico, I ripen off the tree and therefore ship well. If you buy me before I've ripened, you can put me in a brown paper bag for a few days to speed things up, as I produce a gas called ethylene that promotes ripening. Adding an apple or a banana, also ethylene-producing fruits, makes the process even more efficient. To test me for ripeness, apply gentle pressure anywhere on my skin. If it yields, I'm probably ready to eat or to put in the fridge, where the softening process will slow. One last word of caution. There has been a spate of quote-unquote avocado hand, which is what happens when well-meaning guac makers whack their knives at my pit in hopes of dislodging it, but instead find themselves with a blade in the palm. ER doctors report an increase in such incidents and strongly advise caution when preparing me. Please listen to them. My reputation for being both healthy and rich gets dinged when I bite the hand that breeds me. This sidebar, an avocado coffee smoothie recipe. Combine the flesh of one ripe Haas avocado, 1 cup of whole milk, 1/2 cup of sweetened condensed milk, 1 pinch of salt, and 8 ice cubes, and blend until smooth. Blend in 3 tablespoons of strongly brewed coffee, such as an espresso shot, cooled to room temperature. Drizzle chocolate syrup on the inner walls of the serving cups to make a swirl before filling the smoothie. It makes about 2 12-ounce servings. Note, this smoothie also tastes great without the coffee. And for a colder beverage, simply add more ice. Pre-chilling the liquid ingredients in the refrigerator will also help keep the drink cold. Again, that's combining the flesh of 1 ripe Haas avocado, 1 cup of whole milk, 1/2 cup of sweetened condensed milk, 1 pinch of salt, 8 ice cubes, and blend until smooth. Then you can choose to blend in the 3 tablespoons of strongly brewed coffee. And don't forget to drizzle the chocolate syrup on the inner walls of the serving cups, too. This episode of I Am the Food on Your Plate, featuring avocados, is written by Kate Lowenstein, the editor-in-chief of Vice's health website called Tonic, and Daniel Gritzer, the culinary director of the cooking site Serious Eats. Next in Reader's Digest, an article of national interest. American farmers die by suicide at nearly twice the rate of the general population. One Iowa farmer therapist is determined to help them escape the darkness. From The Guardian and the Economic Hardship Reporting Project, here's Debbie Weingarten with A Lifeline in the Heartland in Reader's Digest. It is dark in the workshop, but what light there is streams in patches through the windows. Cobwebs coat the wrenches, the cans of spray paint, and the rungs of an old wooden chair where Matt Peters used to sit. A stereo plays country music, left on by the renter who now uses the shop. "It smells so good in here," I say. "Like men working," finishes Jenny Peters. We inhale. "Yes." Jenny pauses at the desk where she found the letter from Matt, her husband, on the night he died. "My dearest love," it began, and it continued for pages. "I have torment in my head." On the morning of his last day, May 12, 2011, Matt stood in the kitchen of their farmhouse. "I can't think," he told Jenny. "I feel paralyzed." It was planting season, and stress was high. Matt worried about the weather and worked around the clock to get his crop in the ground on time. He hadn't slept in 3 nights and was struggling to make decisions. "I remember thinking, I wish I could pick you up and put you in the car like you do with a child," Jenny says. "And then I remember thinking, and take you where? Who can help me with this? I felt so alone." Jenny felt what she describes as an oppressive sense of dread that intensified as the day wore on. At dinner time, Matt's truck was gone, and he wasn't answering his phone. "It was dark when she found the letter. I just knew," she says. She called 911 immediately, but by the time the authorities located his truck, Matt had taken his life. Jenny describes her husband as strong and determined, funny and loving. They raised two children together. He would burst through the door singing the Mighty Mouse song, "Here I come to save the day," and make everyone laugh. He embraced new ideas and was progressive in his farming practices. One of the first in his country to practice no-till, a farming method that does not disturb the soil. In everything he did, he wanted to be a giver and not a taker, she says. After his death, Jenny says, she began combing through Matt's things. Every scrap of paper, everything I could find that would make sense of what had happened. His phone records showed a 20-minute call to an unfamiliar number on the afternoon he died. When she dialed the number, Mike Rosman answered. "My name is Virginia Peters," she said. "My husband died of suicide on May 12th. There was a pause on the line. "I have been so worried," said Mike. "Mrs. Peters, I'm so glad you called me." Matt had made an appointment to talk to Mike again, but when the time came, he hadn't called. Mike Rosman, an Iowa farmer, is a psychologist and one of the nation's leading experts on the behavioral health of farmers. His mission is to help those in crisis, and for 40 years, he has worked to understand why so many farmers take their own lives. A 2018 analysis by the Centers for Disease Control and Prevention suggests that male farmers die by suicide at nearly twice the rate of the general population. And this could be an underestimate, as the data did not include several major agricultural states. It's also hard to capture an accurate number because some farmers disguise their suicides as accidents. Mike looks like a Midwestern Santa Claus, glasses perched on a kind, round face, a head of white hair, and a bushy white mustache. In 1979, he and his wife, Marilyn Rosman, left their teaching positions at the University of Virginia and bought 190 acres in Harlan, Iowa, near the farm where Mike spent his boyhood. Mike told colleagues, "I need to go and take care of farmers because nobody else does." In the 1980s, the family farm crisis began with the worst agricultural economic forecast since the Great Depression. Market prices crashed. Loans were called in. Interest rates doubled overnight. Farmers were evicted from their land. There were fights at grain elevators, shootings in local banks. Farmers' suicide rates soared. It was a wrecking ball for rural America. So Mike moved back home and opened a psychology practice. Marilyn got a job as a nurse. Together, they raised two children and began farming corn, soybeans, oats, and hay, and raising purebred cattle, chickens, and turkeys. Mike walks with a slight limp. In 1990, during the oat harvest, he lost four of his toes, quote, "in a moment of carelessness," unquote, with the grain combine, an event he describes as life-changing. "We are walking through the wet grass toward the cornfield behind his house when he cranes his head. 'Hear the calves bellering?' he asks. 'They've just been weaned.' We stop and listen. The calves sound out in distressed notes, their off-keyed voices like the cries of prepubescent boys across the field." Mike began providing free counseling, making referrals for services, and coordinating community events to break down the stigma of mental health issues. People just did not deal with revealing their tender feelings. They felt like failures, he says. During the height of the farm crisis, telephone hotlines were started in most agricultural states. Every state that had a hotline reported a significant drop in the number of farming-related suicides. In 1999, Mike joined an organization called Sowing Seeds of Hope, the SSOH, which referred farmers to affordable behavioral health services. In the year 2001, he became the director. For 14 years, until its federal funding ended, SSOH fielded more than 250,000 calls from farmers, trained more than 10,000 rural behavioral health professionals, and provided vouchers for counseling and other resources to some 100,000 farm families. the program became the model for the nationwide Farm and Ranch Stress Assistance Network, also called FERSAN, which was approved as part of the 2008 U.S. Farm Bill but was never funded. Mike continued to help farmers on his own and is now director of AgriWellness, a nonprofit organization that offers behavioral health services in rural areas. The small outfit is trying to fill a big void. Currently, 80% of rural residents live in areas with a shortage of mental health professionals. FarmAid, the organization founded in response to the 1980s farm crisis, reported a 30% increase in calls to its former hotline in 2018 over the year before. Hope may be on the horizon, though, as the 2018 Farm Bill included $10 million in annual funding for FERSAN through the year 2023. Will that be enough? Unfortunately, today's bleak agricultural economy looks very much like a new farm crisis. Income for U.S. farmers has declined nearly 50% since the year 2013 and is at its lowest level since the year 2002, according to the U.S. Department of Agriculture. More than half of farmers lose money, and most have second jobs. Some farmers simply can't afford to keep farming. More than 600 Wisconsin dairy farms shut down last year. Dr. Nancy Zydek, who practices family medicine in Onaga, Kansas, sees behavioral health issues frequently in her patients. The grain prices are low, the gas prices are high. Farmers feel the strain of, I've got to get this stuff in the field, but if I can't sell it, I can't pay for next year's crop. I can't pay my loans at the bank off. And that impacts the rest of us in a small community, because if the farmers can't come into town to purchase from the grocery store, the hardware store, the pharmacy, then those people also struggle. The sky in Onaga is chalk gray, and for a moment it rains. John Blasky's cows are lined up at the fence. Cicadas trill from the trees. It's been a year since he flipped through Missouri Farmer Today and froze, startled by an article written by Mark Rosman, quote, suicide rates of farmers higher than any other group, unquote. I read it 12 or 15 times, John says, sitting next to his wife, Joyce Blasky, at their kitchen table. It hit home something drastically. John is tall and stoic, with hands toughened by work and a somber voice that rarely changes in inflection. He says softly, in the last 25 to 30 years, there's not a day that goes by that I don't think about suicide. Research from the University of Iowa suggests possible causes for farmers' high suicide rate, including social isolation and loneliness, access to guns, financial stress, chronic pain or illness, and ruinously unpredictable weather, a problem now more than ever. Farming has always been a stressful occupation because many of the factors that affect agricultural production are largely beyond the control of the producers, wrote Mike in the Journal of Rural Mental Health. Loss of land can feel like a death, something John understands firsthand. On Thanksgiving Day in 1982, a spark shot out from his wood stove and landed in a box of newspaper. The fire burned most of the Blaskys' house. Soon after, the bank raised their interest rate from 7% to 18%. John raced between banks and private lenders attempting to renegotiate loan terms. Agreements would be made and then fall through. They did not care whether we had to live in a greater ditch, remembers John. Desperate, the family filed for bankruptcy and lost 265 of its 300 acres. That's when John began to think of suicide. I can't leave our property without seeing what we lost, he says. You can't imagine how that cuts into me every day. It just eats me alive. After finding the article in Missouri Farmer Today, he decided to contact Mike. But the article listed a website, and the Blaskys did not own a computer. So John drove to the library and asked a librarian to email Mike for him. A few days later, as John was driving his tractor down the road, Mike called him. He wanted to hear what I had to say, John says. Someone needs to care about what's going on out here. Since the 1980s farm crisis, Mike says, experts have learned much more about how to support farmers. Confidential crisis communications systems, by phone or online, are effective, but staffers need to be versed in the reality and language of agriculture. If you go to a therapist who may know about therapy but doesn't understand farming, Mike explains, the therapist might say, "Take a vacation. That's the best thing you can do." And the farmer will say, "But my cows aren't on a 5-day-a-week schedule." Affordable therapy is critical and inexpensive to fund. Mike says many issues can be resolved in fewer than 5 sessions, which he compares to an employee assistance program, something many companies offer their workers. Medical providers need to be trained to look for physical and behavioral health vulnerabilities in agricultural populations, an effort Mike is working on with colleagues. John Blasky says painting helps him. When he's feeling up to it, he'll paint detailed farmscapes on heavy saw blades. Counseling and medication have also worked well, but he craves conversation with farmers who know what he's experiencing. "I would really give about anything to go and talk to people," he says. "If any one person thinks they are the only one in this boat, they are badly mistaken. It's like Noah's Ark. It's running over." Inside the farmhouse, John places 2 journals in my hands. They're filled with his memories of walking through town barefoot as a child, how his mother would pick sand burrs out of his feet, of the years he worked at the grain elevator only to come home to farm work, counting cows by flashlight. The image of John on the farm, illuminating the darkness, is a powerful one. "Sometimes the batteries were low and the light was not so bright," he wrote, "but when you found the cow that was missing, you also found a newborn calf, which made the dark of night much brighter. And sometimes that ray of light is all you need to see the promise of a new day." This sidebar here about where to find help. Many states offer mental health resources for farmers. Most will help people in need regardless of location. These national organizations are also good places to start. 2 listings here. Number 1, Farm Aid Hotline at 1-800-FARM-AID. That's 1-800-327-6243. farmaid.org/our-work/resources-for-farmers. Just go to farmaid.org and that'll probably find it for you. There's also the National Suicide Prevention Lifeline, 1-800-273-8255. That's 1-800-273-TALK. Also, the website, Suicide Prevention Lifeline, all one word, no spaces, .org. Again, that's the Suicide Prevention Lifeline, .org. And finally, from Reader's Digest, some everyday heroes. First, after a salon turns away a physically challenged woman, a stranger makes a truly beautiful gesture. Here's Andy Simmons of Reader's Digest with Nailed It. "Beauty isn't about having a pretty face," begins a motivational quote. "It's about having a pretty mind, a pretty heart, and a pretty soul. Oh, and pretty nails." That may well be Angela Peters' motto. Last July, Peters, 36 years old, rolled her wheelchair into a nail salon located at the Walmart Shopping Center in Burton, Michigan, with the idea of bedazzling her fingers. But Peters, who has cerebral palsy, was turned away. The salon, which is not owned by Walmart, she says, told her that they were afraid it would be too difficult to properly paint her nails, given that her hands shook. What was meant to be a day of beauty bliss for Peters was now a disappointment. Watching the interaction from a few feet away was a Walmart cashier about to go on her break. Ebony Harris, 40 years old, recognized Peters as a Walmart regular. Now what she recognized in Peters was a kindred spirit. "She's a girly girl," Harris told ABC 12 of Flint, Michigan. "She's just like you, me, my daughter, anybody. She wants to look pretty. So why can't she?" Harris approached Peters. "Do you want me to do your nails?" she asked. A smile spread across Peters' face. "Yeah!" Harris escorted Peters into the beauty aisle, where they shopped for nail polish. They settled on a bright blue, a statement color that would catch every eye. Then they made their way into a neighboring Subway, found a table for two, and set up shop. Harris gently took Peters' hand into hers and carefully began painting her nails. She moved her hands a little bit, and she kept saying she was sorry, Harris recalls. I told her, "Don't say that. You're fine." If anything, the shoe was on the other hand, as it were. "I was a little nervous and was shaking because I didn't want to mess her nails up," Harris admitted to ABC News. "I told her she's a blessing to us, to anybody, not just me. She makes me look at life and appreciate it much more than I have." A fellow Walmart employee stopped by to suggest that the blue nails could do with a little extra zing. So they added some glitter polish. Watching it all with awe and admiration was Subway employee Tasia Smith. What struck her most was the ease and gentleness displayed by Harris as she painted Peters' nails, all the while chatting as if they were old friends. Smith was so taken by the scene that she wrote about it on Facebook. "They were so patient with her," she wrote. "Thank you to the Walmart workers for making this beautiful girl's day." Peters, who runs a poetry website, heavenlypoems.com, all one word, no spaces, harbors no bitterness toward the nail salon that turned her away. The salon claims they denied Peters' service because they were too busy. "When people do us wrong, we must forgive," Peters wrote on Facebook. "I just want to educate people that people with different challenges, like being in a wheelchair, can have our own business and get our nails done just like anyone else." Though in Peters' case, there was certainly something special about this manicure. Flaring out her fingers to better show off her nails, she told ABC 12, "I'm like, wow, these are amazing." Here's another everyday hero in Reader's Digest. Juliana LaBianca writes, "The Iceman to the Rescue." Cruz Guinea, 11 years old, and Anthony Skopik, 10 years old, couldn't agree. Were the birds out on the ice ducks or geese? There was only one way to find out. So, on a chilly January evening last year, the two friends ventured onto the frozen pond near their homes in Frankfort, Illinois, to get a better look. First, they tossed a rock onto the ice to test it, Cruz told NBC5 Chicago. Then we stepped on it. Convinced the ice would hold their weight, Anthony took a few steps, then, phoomph, he crashed through the seemingly frozen surface. "There was no sound, no crack," he told ABC7 Chicago. "I just fell through instantly." Cruz rushed to help his panicked friend. Phoomph, the pond swallowed him too. Cruz managed to lift himself out of the frigid water and onto a more solid section. He then gingerly worked his way toward Anthony. But the ice didn't hold and he fell in again. This time, he couldn't get out. The boys were up to their necks in icy water and quickly losing feeling in their limbs. Any chance of their freeing themselves was slipping away. Cruz was sure he was going to die. Anthony's older sister had seen the boys fall through the ice and started screaming for help. John Lavin, a neighbor driving nearby on his way to the grocery store, heard her. He quickly pulled over. Seeing the boys, he grabbed a nearby buoy, kicked off his shoes, and ran into the slushy water, chopping his way through the ice with his free fist. "It was kind of a Hulk smash," Lavin told NBC5 Chicago. Lavin made his way to Cruz and Anthony and hauled them back to land. They were taken to the hospital, where doctors discovered that their 5-minute stay in the water had lowered their body temperature nearly 10 degrees. Fortunately, the boys have fully recovered, though they are still a little awestruck by their fearless neighbor. "Just to think," says Cruz, "if he wasn't there, I would have died." Let's close out this edition of Reader's Digest with some humor from Laughter, the Best Medicine. Two dog owners are arguing about whose pet is smarter. "My dog is so smart," says the first owner, "that every morning he goes to the store and buys me a sesame seed bagel with chive cream cheese, stops off at Starbucks and picks me up a mocha latte, and then comes home and turns on ESPN all before I get out of bed. I know, says the second owner. How do you know? The first owner demands. My dog told me. Thank you for listening to today's Reader's Digest. If you have questions or comments about the program, please call us at 210-829-4223. This program is replayed after 9 o'clock in the evening. This is John Fisher saying goodbye from Owl Radio and the Low Vision Resource Center in San Antonio.